Blog Talk Radio.
This is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call and listen by dialing on your phone, 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Productions sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our first guest is Cirilla Sparkling Tea founder and owner, Saren Stender Delaney. We will talk about trading fairly with Rwandan tea growers and the impact her products consumers are having in Rwanda. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Wayne. It's great to be here this evening. How are you?
I am pretty good. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Okay, so I know you're in.
Talk with you and you're, yeah.
I know you're in North Carolina, correct?
I am, yeah. I'm in Asheville, North Carolina. That's where our company is headquartered.
Great. Today I'm in Gary, Indiana, but of the 55 countries in Africa, as recognized by the African Union, how did you begin a relationship with Rwanda?
Yeah, that's a common question people ask me. It's pretty a pretty unique connection, I suppose. Rwanda is quite a small country in terms of the landmass. I actually grew up in Vermont, and Rwanda is the same size as Vermont, but with many, many more people. So I think there's now around 12 million people in Rwanda, whereas Vermont has less than 1 million. So it's a pretty densely populated country, but it doesn't feel crowded. It's very mountainous. It's spread out. There's lots of farming. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. I had the opportunity to live there for a year in 2009. I actually landed in Rwanda for the first time the same night as President Obama's inauguration speech on January 20th. And so that was a really powerful experience to arrive. And then, you know, we left the airport and they had on the big screens of President Obama giving his speech. So I lived there for a year. Yeah. I mean, they saw him as their brother, their family, because he had, you know, his father, I mean, he had roots to Kenya. So people were really, really excited. And it was a really amazing time to arrive there. And the people I met in Rwanda, I mean, they just welcomed me with open arms. I felt really, really, it's just such a loving place. And, you know, people often are surprised because of the tragedy and just horrible history of the genocide of 1994. But it's very, it's peaceful and I mean, just amazing, amazing people.
But how did you get connected to Rwanda of all the countries on the continent?
I know. It's amazing. It's really meant to be. I mean, I really do believe that we're guided on the path. You know, if we listen closely enough, we're guided to what we're meant to do. And so it took me a while to get there. But in my early 20s, I was living up in Boston. I had just graduated college. And I was working for an investment bank, and I had this life that it looked good on the outside. Like, people thought I had it together. I did well in school. I traveled abroad in college, and I experienced a really horrible thing. And I had post-traumatic stress disorder, and to try to forget about what happened, I was drinking every night. So like by day I had one life, and then by night I started to isolate. I started feeling anxiety and depression, And I really didn't feel like I was on my path. Like, I knew that I had something, you know, to do in this lifetime that was meaningful, but I didn't feel like I was doing it. And one night it was like the hand of God kind of like brought me into this movie store back when we had movie stores. And literally, I mean, this movie fell off the shelf, and it was like an unknown documentary. It was not Hotel Rwanda, because this was years before. It was this unknown documentary about women, these women in Rwanda who had lost almost everything. I mean, it was just the most gut-wrenching, heartbreaking movie, but I brought it home with me and watched it by myself that night, and it broke it, like, my heart open. I was hearing, watching these stories, and I felt like I finally could feel my own pain in, like, hearing theirs. And it helped me on my healing journey. I'm not just, I mean, I was about 22, 22 at that time, and it took me another 8 years to really start studying, and I went back to school. I got my master's in organizational development. I studied nonprofits and leadership and change, and I got my life together, and I headed to Rwanda. Well, I was actually first offered a job there, which was just another God thing. I mean, I knew one day I wanted to go to Rwanda and just learn about, you know, learn from the women, whether they were from that exact movie or not. I knew that it was a place I needed to go and, like, really kind of dig deep into what this resiliency was and how people could overcome what they had overcome. And so fast forward, I moved down here to Asheville, and I was offered a job to move to Rwanda, seemingly out of the blue. And it really, the job description fit my qualifications, and I didn't even think twice about it. I mean, I just knew it was meant to be. And so it just all fell into place. You know, I've heard some people ask, you know, what about all the logistics? You know, how do you just, like, get up and leave? I mean, I'd never been there before. But, you know, when things are meant to happen, it kind of happens easily. Like, it like flows, and I just trusted, and everything fell into place. And I got there, and I was the managing director of a social enterprise, which really was a startup restaurant, and it was created to provide technical and job skills for young adults. Really, they had been very young children when they lost their parents in the genocide. So they were considered orphans technically, but at this point they were between like 18 and 27. And so there were 25 people that I worked with, and we built and eventually created like one of the best restaurants in the country. So it was like a hands-on training facility. And in that time, you know, I just absolutely fell in love with the country, and I knew I had to keep going back.
So what year did this chain of events start?
Yeah, I lived there in 2009. And then, you know, I eventually made my way back to the States, and then I've been back. I mean, I've been going back regularly ever since. So, I would say probably the first email I ever sent to Rwanda was to this man. It was actually 2007. I was working in fair trade in the States, and I learned about this certified organic coffee farm in Rwanda. And of course, with my fascination of Rwanda, like, I somehow found he had an email address, and we corresponded, and he told me about his coffee farm and welcomed me into his country. And I was, you know, just amazed, because at that time he was being very proactive about going through the certification to be organic. It was a little ahead of, you know, not many people were doing it, and it's an expensive thing for farmers to do. So that got the ball rolling with me engaging with farmers. At that time, it was coffee farmers. Later on, it would be tea pluckers.
Yeah, so I understand, too, that you wrote your dissertation, but this was in 2007, so it was 2 years before your chain of events, and it was called Mainstreaming Fair Trade through corporate participation in the fair trade market. So in 2007, did what you're doing now, was the business plan of what you're doing now included in your dissertation, or did that come later?
Oh, wow. That's such good research. You know, I never really thought about it that way, but the business plan for what I'm doing now came a lot later. But that project was really, I was unpacking the role of multinationals in the fair trade movement, because I was working in the fair trade movement. I was an activist, but I was on the U.S. side. So I was really starting to explore, is this certification really the best thing? You know, is this trickling down to the farmers, or is it something else? You know, it's definitely a good marketing, but I started questioning the whole system. And so that's what I was getting at in that project. And I was looking at that time, I think it was Walmart and Sam's Club, and really asking the question, like, is this, not only is it good for the farmers who are growing the ingredients that, you know, are going into these products we're buying that are fair trade certified, but is it good that we're seeing, I mean, at that time it was called fair washing, and now, you know, we see greenwashing, and it's like a lot of companies use these things to let their consumers know that they're doing good things in the world. But does it matter? Does it matter what their intention is, or is it just a good thing that they've got the certified products in their stores because that's helping the farmers? So in the end, you know, I think the more we can get that message across and in front of more people, and if those are the stores where the most people are shopping, I do think it's a good thing that fair trade certification is mainstream. I think everything, you know, those are basic human environmental rights that every company should meet, but it's just the minimum. It's like we're just scratching the surface with that program. It's not even close to where we need to be. So, I mean, my hat's off,
that's the feeling I get half the time, because if all the companies who practice fair trade was actually practicing fair trade, I would think that a lot more changes in the world would have taken place already.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, then if you dig deep, you know, into what fair trade really means, and like what the boxes are, that there's a lot of different certification programs. So there's different third parties that come into play there. In the U.S., you know, there's Fair Trade USA, but the standards are different. So it's really not that difficult. It's not that difficult to meet the minimum standards. And my goal with the business model that I'm creating is to make it far more inclusive and with upward mobility with all people involved. So the problem is, like, you know, if we buy a sack of coffee, for example, like there is a fair trade premium that's paid on that, some cents, but the cents don't necessarily go back to the individual farmers. Most likely they'll go back to a cooperative, and then the cooperative does have leadership in place where they can decide where that fair trade premium goes. So it does often go to good things, you know, and like maybe builds a school or a soccer field or a library. So not to say, you know, there's benefits, but in terms of like, are the people actually making a living wage? It's hard to tell.
Gotcha. So you mentioned earlier too, that before you got your company started, Cirilla Sparkling Tea, that you did work for some investors, I believe, and you've also been involved in fair trade as a activist, as a person who read their research and other things. So you were pretty much prepared in many ways. But how did you get your company off the ground? Did you become an S corporation? Did you use crowdfunding? Did you have investors? What did you do?
Right. So after I came back to the States from Rwanda, I started a nonprofit first. So we set up a 501c3 as a foundation. And that was really in response to, you know, when I lived in Rwanda, I really was observing what like who the businesses were that were engaging there and what kind of business they were doing, and what the involvement of the farmers and producers were in that whole business chain, and then also what the NGO sector was, you know, made up of there. And so I was seeing that a lot of the programs were really not developed in partnership with the local population. So I partnered with, you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, so you partnered with? Yeah. Yeah, so we actually first developed the Africa Healing Exchange, which is a nonprofit 501c3 organization, and that was to provide trauma healing resources, and together with a group of women in Rwanda and also some outside mental health professionals, we created a resiliency model. And so that really helped lay the foundation for emotional well-being and access to social services. And then from there, as the women that we were working with started to feel, I guess, more grounded and balanced and like more, you know, they had more tools to navigate our day-to-day life and stressors, they started asking for entrepreneurship training. So over time, it just happened organically that, you know, the nonprofit still exists, but I started to see for them and also like for myself, it's like, well, part of the whole like healing cycle is also financial healing and economic empowerment and upward mobility in that way. And so it just, the natural next step was to create a business. And I knew that I wanted in some way for the for-profit business to be beneficial to the farmers and producers in a different way than fair trade. So we do work through the fair trade system, but we're, you know, our goal is to go above and beyond that. So I explored different products. You know, Rwanda is like produces some really, really amazing products, and there's just amazing artisans. I mean, they have gorgeous, beautiful baskets. You might see them in places like 10,000 Villages, amazing coffee. And then there's the tea, you know, so I'm looking at all these things. I'm like, what can we make the greatest impact with? And also like have a really successful business that's going to really, really hit like where the market is in the States and other countries. And so I was just really examining the trends and like, you know, at one point I was looking at coffee, but it's like really coffee. I mean, I drink coffee too. Okay. Coffee is my first love. But like, I know tea is better for me. It's better for me. It's better for my body. It's trending upward so fast with consumer awareness. It's better for the environment. And it's a better business for the farmers. Like coffee is typically only harvested once or twice a year. I've never seen anyone move out of poverty if they're just coffee farming. I just don't see how it's possible. So that's a tough business, and I think there's a lot of amazing coffee businesses already, but really like the time was right to really launch into the tea business. And so that's what I chose as the primary vehicle and primary change maker. And that's where I started Three Mountains, which is a holding company for two consumer packaged good brands, Cirilla, which is the sparkling tea that I invented, and that's made with premium loose leaf Rwandan tea. So we have four flavors. We got a specialty food association nominated, awarded us the best ready to drink last year for our original flavor, which is made with black tea, silver needle tea, a splash of organic lemon juice, and just a touch of raw organic cane sugar. So I wanted to create a modern twist on a timeless category. You know, iced tea, ready-to-drink tea has been around for a long time, but I thought it was time to shake it up, you know. And this is like really an idea that came out of my kitchen. And I started by importing the loose leaf tea, and then as a non-drinker, because I did quit drinking in my 20s, which was a while ago, and I haven't had alcohol. I know a lot of people who are trying to drink less alcohol. So I actually created Sterilla in kegs to have on tap as a non-alcoholic option in breweries here. And then, you know, that's where I did my proof of concept, and I started canning and launched into grocery stores about a year and a half ago. Under a different name, and we just did a rebrand and relaunch this winter. So I've really been bootstrapping it mainly, kind of back to what I said, like a lot of people, you know, have asked, you know, how much money does this take? Like you must have either deep pockets or big investors. And I mean, it's a combination of things, but if I had known like what it would take or how much it would cost, I might not have done it. But like, I mean, that's the beauty of being an entrepreneur is like we have to have a little bit of ignorance and be a little naive going into things. Otherwise, you know, we might not pursue it. But things show up when they're needed. I really trust that. And
so in short, you started off as a nonprofit. And then you created a for-profit or a business, and you used a combination
right.
of funding. And you've used a combination of funding.
So we have two separate entities. So the nonprofit is a standalone foundation, and that's strictly to fund the mental health and resiliency services that are offered in Rwanda where we work. So that's a separate entity. And then, last year when everything shut down, you know, I did do some fundraising to help with emergency relief efforts there. And so that would go through the nonprofit. If we're, like, right now we're in kind of a dire situation this week with the volcano that erupted on Saturday, and we have earthquakes happening this week in Rwanda. So it's been a tough situation. But the business is a separate entity. And that houses the for-profit. We are pursuing benefit corporation status with Three Mountains. So that's we're hitting the requirements for that. It's a lot of paperwork, and as it should be. I think it's an incredible program. I think for anyone out there who sees like B Corp certification on a product, I mean, that's a great, great sign that that company is trying to do the right thing in the world.
But if someone was like you and trying to copy your ability to raise funds to do these type of things as a for-profit business, which models would you tell them to use or suggest to use?
Oh, yeah. I would tell them to go for the for-profit. So if they can actually pursue the benefit corporation status from the very beginning, I would say that's a great way to go. And I think it's called the B Labs. They provide free resources and free support as you're getting started with that application process. But if you're not ready to do that, I mean, simply setting up an LLC, that's what I did. I mean, I set up an LLC on LegalZoom for like $250, I think. That was in June of 2016 when I officially got that started and then slowly started selling, you know. But at that time, I still had other jobs. It wasn't my full-time thing. I didn't have the sparkling tea. I wasn't in grocery stores. I kind of, you know, got started in like cafes and bakeries and packaging myself and learning as I went. So, but you know, I'm now starting to get involved with raising capital from investors. So I am taking that next step to bring on investors for the business.
Okay. Oh, I see. So when you started, you didn't have the investors. Now that you've gotten started and use your personal funds and I guess maybe some friends' funds, now you're starting to look for investors.
Exactly. Yeah, I did the friends and family round and made it as far as I could and started generating revenue to cover upcoming, you know, growth and expenses. And I would say, you know, for anyone getting started, the longer you can hold out on bringing investors in, I think that's a smart move because, you know, you want to build the value of your company before someone else is going to be taking or receiving equity in exchange for an investment. And when you're so young, it's really hard to put a value on the business because it's all projections about what you're going to do in the future. So for me, I'm a solopreneur. I don't have a business partner. But for someone who is looking to launch a business with a partner, you know, that's a whole nother story. And I think both people are going to be putting in sweat equity and also finances.
Okay, so let's talk about the T and me.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about you and what's your tea drinking style?
And what does it say about me and that I'm not a big fan of canned sparkling black tea? I mean, you sent me the samples and I was like, black tea, I don't think I like this too much. But I love, love the loose lemongrass tea, which I found surprising because I'm not a lemongrass fan, but I love the loose lemongrass tea. So that says something about me that I don't like black tea. Maybe I like loose tea. Maybe I like lemongrass now. What's going on in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you like something. And I mean, yeah, you gave it all a try. And, you know, I would say a lot of people either lean towards the traditional Camellia sinensis tea, which is the black tea, or they lean towards the herbal tea. And the herbal is a tisane. And so, you know, that Tulsi lemongrass blend is to die for. I mean, that is so popular. I drink that most nights and it's really calming, but it doesn't knock you out if you drink it during the day. And you know, the primary ingredient in that is Tulsi holy basil. And that's a really great adaptogen. We also weave in some oat straw in that blend, and oat straw is a little bit naturally sweet. And it also helps balance out people's adrenal glands, especially if we consume caffeine, which I do. So when I have caffeine in the morning, I like to have oat straw in the evening. It, you know, kind of helps balance it out. It calms, it soothes. And the lemongrass is also a natural astringent. That blend is very much an immune booster and antioxidant. But all tea is really a strong antioxidant because the Camellia sinensis tea plant, and you're suggesting maybe like the black tea isn't for you, that is, it can be astringent. It has very strong polyphenols. And there's a chemical compound called L-theanine. And the L-theanine in black, green, and white tea is it's the original superfood. I mean, this is a very, very powerful immune booster and antioxidant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear a lot of people that's really
so I love it. You know, I love it because there's all these – go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because people who really are into teas tell me there's all these differences as you – say they are, but I've never really understood it enough or taken the time enough to learn. I'm just one of those people who taste it and say, okay, I like this, I don't like this. But the other thing I'd really like too was the packaging. The packaging of the loose teas are great for gifts. I mean, those are just absolutely great. I really love the packaging. What made you come up with the triangle looking, I don't know if it's tin or
oh
this.
Oh my God.
But it's, and I love it when you open it. It's like it's like it feels like it's sealed.
Yeah. Thanks for noticing that. I mean, it takes a long time to create the packaging. It was such a process, and I mean, there's a catalog, right? You can get these catalogs with like every kind of tin imaginable. And I just knew I wanted to do something different. I didn't want another square tin. I wanted to do it, you know, as I don't believe there's anything as sustainable packaging, but I wanted to be as eco as possible. And believe it or not, like aluminum, you know, is more environmentally friendly than some other materials because you can recycle that. And I was hoping maybe people would reuse it. I don't know if you noticed, but there's little like ideas on how to reuse the tin on the back. I mean, my son came up with one idea. It was like, don't lose your marbles, kind of like, you know, business cards, like all these different creative ideas. So our logo was already created and it was a triangle. And the triangle to me symbolizes unity. It symbolizes recovery. It symbolizes resilience, and bringing people together. And also there's three points in a triangle, and our company is Three Mountains. So it's a really powerful symbol and shape. And so I wanted the shape of the 10 to match that. But here's the flip side of that for anyone going into this business, is like, always talk to retailers about what they want to put on their shelf too, because I mean, this is a very unique item, but we also have to fit the dimensions of the shelf space if that's going to be the place that we're selling. So,
exactly.
So it's good to be different, but sometimes it's not good to be too different.
So I guess you did run into problems with the fact that the shape of it is a little bit different. Well, the shape
yeah,
is different.
Because I mean,
because
yeah,
it's not perfectly square, so you can't just push it into the back of the into it on the shelf because it's not perfectly
exactly.
square.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we had the same problem when we stored inside the shelf at home. It's like, okay, so we had to move this and this away so they fit.
Oh, God.
But it's okay.
It's funny.
Because I love the way
it looks.
It's
okay.
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
So
Did you get any of the silver tea?
Yeah, one of them I haven't had yet. But the silver tea, I believe I had too. And I can't remember which one is which now, but one of them I liked a little bit better. But I did notice that they all were black tea. And I kept thinking, wow, maybe it's the black tea that is not agreeing with me as much as I wanted to. I said, well, some people must really love black tea.
And I
understand that black tea is very popular out here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of our readers, in fact, is a Kenyan farmer, and he tells me, yes, black tea is very popular.
Yeah, the traditional East African tea. Well, so Kenya, he might have told you, East Africa produces 17% of the world's tea, which is kind of a little known fact. Most of that is
right.
from Kenya. Mm-hmm. But we don't really see that on the labels. We're not seeing Kenyan. I mean, sometimes you see Kenyan tea. But the tea that's produced in Rwanda is typically black. It's typically CTC, which is called it's a crushed tea leaf, and that's crushed up and put into tea bags and sold typically to like the UK, not so much in the US. So I really wanted to also use this platform to help build awareness for the Rwandan brand in general. And so that we could start seeing, you know, Rwandan tea on packaging as a single origin, single garden product. Like we're starting to see that with coffee. I think people are starting to realize like some of the world's best coffee comes out of Rwanda and other East African countries, but it took a while for that too.
Right. Well, before we go in the last 3 minutes, can you tell me more about corporate responsibility? We've talked a lot about corporate responsibility, but can you explain more how when I make a purchase from your company, how I am being a responsible consumer who is helping a company be profitable that is being responsible? Or in short, how are you using my support to be responsible?
Thank you so much for asking that question. I love that. For us, it's really about the people and the planet, you know, and then it's like the people come first. The farmers are the very, very beginning of the supply chain and are often the ones that are forgotten. And so we have to demand from our companies that every person involved in producing those products are treated with respect, with kindness, with dignity, and that they have the opportunity for upward mobility in their careers, right? So if they want additional training or if they are seeking some other kind of jobs, they have that opportunity. So that's really, really important. And then also, what are we doing to try to combat the effects of climate change? What are we doing with our packaging? You know, how are we even choosing the shipment? I mean, all those things we can't expect consumers to necessarily know, and it might not be on the website, But I think you can get a pretty good idea from a website, and you can get a pretty good idea by skimming the packaging of a company. And yes, it's great to look for those certifications. If you see the Benefit Corporation certification, those standards are very, very, very high. So I can trust that a company is not only doing the right thing if they have that, but it means it's rooted in their mission. So that's a big difference, is like, how was the company founded? Were they founded on these values, or did they adopt them for a good marketing strategy? You know, what are their origins? And look into their founder, you know, look into their corporate culture. So I hope that helps.
It does. And Sarah, I want to thank you for taking the time to do what you're doing and to explain to us why it's important for us to be better consumers and to work with companies like yours. And so we have your on our webpage, and everything else is related to your being in Port of Harlem Magazine, is a link to your website. And I do know that you are in stores, and there's a link to where you can find what stores you're in, but you also make purchase available online. Is that correct?
That's correct. We have drinkcirilla.com, and Cirilla is also on Amazon now. And we have drinktima.com. That's T-I-M-A. And let's make sure you don't run out of that Tulsi lemongrass tea.
Well, believe me, I might, because I plan on that. That's one of my two gifts as a gift items.
Okay. All right.
Well, because I tell you, those canisters make me look good.
Yeah, they're definitely special. Well, now you know the backstory too. So thank you for your support and for this opportunity. I've really enjoyed our conversation tonight.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
You too. Bye.